You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Yesterday's election results, and interestingly enough, all fingers pointed at the greenies in Ohio's 12th. And look, nice scapegoat, and I was hoping last night, as we were talking about the results, that it wouldn't be everyone pointing at the greenies. I was hoping that we would come around to the idea that, the Republicans have done enough already to steal most elections across the country, and the numbers have to be overwhelming to push back. But it's easy to point at the greenies. And while I don't understand why you would, in a very competitive race, go and cast a ballot for someone who doesn't stand a snowball's chance, outside of you're just a contrarian. You just want to voice protest. And most of the people who I know who do that, that's what it's about. We hate both of them. So we're just showing our disdain for both of them. That's fine. You do what you got to do. Personally, as I've always thought, I would like to have a say in who wins. But just showing up for a protest vote, perfectly fine. Thank you for showing up, greenies. You made your point. Now, interestingly enough, this yesterday a really interesting day in that you had Kris Kobach, who evidently we're not going to know who won the governor's primary there in Kansas for a couple of days. And also, and this is the really bizarre little twist of Kansas law, Kris Kobach is the Secretary of State there in Kansas who oversees elections. So he will be overseeing his own election. He will be the one who is responsible for the recount and all of this stuff. He's going to be the one certifying the recount. Does anyone see a problem with that? Just kind of throwing that out there because, look, I don't trust him as far as I can throw him, and I could probably throw him a couple of feet. This just seems like a glitch in the law that needs to be addressed. Now, as I understand, he's refusing to recuse himself, which I guess perfectly within the bounds of the law he can do. But I look at this guy. I mean, it's really telling that we're at this moment. You have an election that is so close. And you have this guy who has been at the forefront of stealing people's votes. And now he's in charge of overseeing a system where his policy, his belief, his idea of stealing votes is actually in play. And And look, it's not just Kansas where his poison is. Ohio is another one of those places. Because, and we've had Greg Palast on the program a number of times, and I need to reach back out to Greg on this. But, you know, Greg back in June pointed out that a lot of, especially in Ohio, things were going to be rigged from the beginning because of the state Supreme, because of the Supreme Court case that came out of Ohio, which was Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute, which basically said, we can start purging people. So you're looking at, what, a bunch of people who have been purged off the voting rolls. I heard someone tell me today somewhere between 3 and 10,000 people in the 12th district didn't get the vote because they were ousted. You think that could have had something to do with it, especially because we know this beyond adventure, that the people who get purged are generally people who vote for Democrats. We know beyond adventure that they're the poor, the working class, the people who move around a little bit. And, oh, the people who have names that sound like felons. You know, like Brown and Jackson and Smith. So I look at the results out of the 12th and really very remarkable that it was as razor thin as it was. And I keep coming back to, while the Russia thing is important, really, really very important, and while their interference, meddling, attack, whatever words you want to use for their behavior, is unacceptable and is destructive to our democracy, what the Republicans have done, much worse in my view, the gerrymandering, the voter suppression, the voter ID, all the moving the polling places. In Detroit, you had polling places that were out without electricity for a while, which you go, how is that possible? And if you're in a place that's vulnerable to that, hey, I know one way that it won't matter if the voting machines aren't plugged into a wall. That's if you give someone a piece of paper. I'm old school. I do believe in old school. Piece of paper, a marker, something permanent, not one of those pencils that can be erased, and a check mark. And in the box and big and whatever. No hanging chads, none of that nonsense. Clear intent of vote. And we won't have these problems. And I watched the election returns last night. And again, as I was watching the 12th, I'm going, man, you know, another one so close. So close. Down to the wire. And it's amazing how it's just so close. We're almost there. And the messaging that comes out of it. This is why anybody who has been paying attention, if you haven't voted, you got to get to the polls. And don't be, because I'm saying that I think the game is already rigged, that is not a ticket for you to go, oh, it's rigged, I'm not going to participate. This should be one of those moments where everyone goes, I now have to participate. I now have to push back against what's being thrown out at us. I now have to be the one who's going to step up, stand forward, and speak out. I'm going to have to be the one that saves things. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, at some point we seriously need to be much more vigilant. Much more vocal, much more in the face, if you will. Now, also the big news for me last night, Missouri. And this is, again, is another one of those moments that I remember 2011. I remember being in Ohio for the SB5 fight. I remember, you know, all of the messaging that was going on there. You're John Kasich, and either you get on the bus or we're going to run over you. That stuff from 2011 where they rammed through right to work there. And the voters, you know, they spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of money to get a question on the ballot to overturn it. And the voters came out overwhelmingly 2-1 against Kasich's SB5, the issue 2 vote. And this was even, if you remember back to 2011, the right wing actually to lather up their base. And this is one of those really incredible dynamics that I think almost nobody at the time talked about it except me. But, you know, issue two was the right to work stuff, was the repeal of right to work in Ohio. Issue number one was a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. It was going after Obamacare and making Ohio not a state that to expand. And interestingly enough, it did exactly what the right-wingers wanted. It got people out. It brought people out to vote against the Affordable Care Act. And in fact, the number of people voting against the Affordable Care Act was almost identical to the people who were voting to restore workers' rights in Ohio. It was like a 2-to-1 question. And you know, the right-wingers thought, hey, we're going to get our base out. We're going to get those union-hating Republicans out, and they're going to vote overwhelmingly to crush Obama and to crush those unions. Well, oddly enough, those Republicans did come out, and they voted to restore union strength. And this is kind of what we saw last night in Missouri. You know, we're told Missouri's a red state now. And we're told that, you know, Claire McCaskill is going to get crushed, and that this union stuff, this attack on union, was just going to slide right through. But understand, working people get it, and this is a message for the Democratic Party. This truly is the message to where you pick up what happened in Missouri, you pick up the mantle, and say, look. Two-thirds of the people in this country, in the state of Missouri, the state of Ohio, when they had the opportunity to vote on this, they stood by unions. They stood by giving workers a chance at a better opportunity for tomorrow. This is what Democrats, this is the message Democrats need to pick up and carry forward. Restore the ability for workers to join and form unions. Return to the original intent. You want to talk about original intent? Let's talk about the original intent of the National Labor Relations Act. There is not one sentence in that act, not one word, not one syllable in that entire act that grants employers any rights whatsoever. Everything in that act is giving employees, workers, the ability to have a seat at the table. It's giving workers rights. Because they understood back then, and we should understand right now, that the employer holds all the cards. They have all the power. It is a dictatorial regime. It is authoritarian. You are told when to show up, what to do, how to do it, where to do it, when to do it, when to take a lunch, if you can go to the bathroom, if you can't go to the bathroom. Everything throughout your day is controlled. And the original Wagner Act, the original intent was to give people a little bit of power to be able to bargain on what happens to them during the day, during their work lives, to give them a chance at a better tomorrow. And from that moment forward, understand, the moneyed interests of this country and the Republican Party have been the fringe of the Republican Party. Have been pursuing destruction of those rights. And understand, I use the Republican Party as, you know, there were the Southern Democrats back then who are the current heart of the Republican Party today, who are also on the wrong side of history. So, you know, don't get me in the middle of, you know, the Republicans were one way. You're right. Back then, there were some crazy Democrats. There were some crazy, hateful conservative Democrats, and they're now gone. And where have they gone? They've gone on to lead the Republican Party and push the kind of poison that we are seeing right now. But good on the folks of Missouri. Fantastic, in my view. And again, like I said, this should be one of those things that Democrats pick up and run with. Got a great show tonight. Lots to get into, lots to talk about. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kristen Mink's going to be here. You may remember her. She's the woman, the school teacher, the mother who confronted Scott Pruitt in the restaurant, told him to resign, told him to gather the sheep and get the flock out. I look forward to talking to her next. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1902. That was the day more than 100 trade union delegates representing thousands of working people in St. Paul, Minnesota, elected Charles James to be the president of the city's Trades and Labor Assembly. Virtually forgotten by history, James is considered to be the first African-American elected to a city labor council anywhere in America. He was born in 1866 in St. Paul and began working as a leather cutter for local shoe manufacturers at age 15. This was at a time when most African-Americans were excluded from skilled trades. His biographer Dave Riley asserts that it is unclear when James became involved in union politics and organizing. Shoemaking was the largest mass production industry in St. Paul, employing thousands. Riley notes that the Knights of Labor had been active in the city during the 1880s, and shoe workers were among the first to organize. By 1899, James had become the first president of a newly formed shoe workers union in Minneapolis, and helped to found three more locals in St. Paul. By 1902, James was well known and well respected throughout the Twin Cities as a strong union leader. He served three terms as president of the Trades Assembly and then as secretary for seven more years. Riley states that James continued as a full-time organizer and district business agent, traveling to cities across the Midwest to organize shoe workers. When he died in 1923, the Boot and Shoe Workers Union eulogized him in their national journal. Though James had been obscured from local labor history for decades, Riley and others have worked to write Charles James back into the history books.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
There is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
Cause, brothers, it's a fact. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Leave some green on the ground. It's only there's tomorrow. Let's save some for tomorrow.
Oh, yes. Good old crazy Michelle Bachmann. Miss her. Miss her a lot. At least she was somewhat fun. Not on the fringe, but somewhat fun. Not the mean and I don't know, just a different era. But hasn't that been the mantra that the right has thrown out at us? That regulations are just job killers. Without really talking about the fact that, guess what? Without regulation, without sane policy, without the cop on the beat, we end up having people killing lack of regulations or lack of protections. And you look at the story that broke this week. The fact that the Trump administration is going to allow, in whatever fashion, they're trying to explain it. I guess we're making asbestos great again. I guess now we know what MAGA stands for. And in fact, the Russians are so thrilled about it, they slapped a picture of him on the side of the packaging for their asbestos poison. So I guess asbestosis and mesothelioma are going to be great again. The good thing, at least those lawyers at 3 o'clock in the morning are going to have unlimited business going forward. But I'll tell you, it's time for us to step up, stand up, step forward and speak out. And my next guest did just that. You may remember the story of the mother, the school teacher, the activist who approached Scott Pruitt and said, time for you to go. There's the door. Gather the sheep. Get the flock out, which is why I've asked Kristen Mink to come talk with us. Kristen, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the question I'm sure you've heard 1,000 times already. What made you approach Pruitt and confront him?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, who wouldn't want that guy a piece of their mind? I mean, he's a guy who hides from the press. He doesn't release his schedule. And meanwhile, he's using taxpayer money to buy, stupid stuff like tactical pants and first-class seats so he doesn't have to interact with the rest of us and spending all of his time rolling back the regulations that are supposed to protect us. So, to see him out in public was a real treat, and I knew immediately that I wanted to talk to him and give him a piece of my mind. Right. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I've attended protests and done, you know, stuff like that and asked this thing, but really in that moment, I, like, you know, I had my kid with me, and I'm here I am looking at this guy who's, like, ruining my child's future, you know, for the next generation. So something definitely came up in me. I don't want to talk to him.
No, I mean, you know, the reality is I don't know that in that situation I would have stopped, which is why I probably wouldn't have done it, because I know myself. But good on you for you know, and for having the mind to actually record it so the rest of us could enjoy it.
Well, you know, there was always a chance that you're going to say something, like, smart and insightful and helpful in the moment. You gotta have that. Kidding, that was never going to happen.
Now you're getting credit for him actually resigning, because shortly after that he found the door. You know, I'm still wondering if he got to keep the Superman phone booth and the $1,500 bed, if those were his parting gifts. But you know, you're getting credit for, you know, you're getting the credit for, you know, pushing him out the door.
I don't think that I should get a whole lot of credit for that, because so many people have been working on getting him out the door. Well, you know, since he took office, you know, from environmentalists and activists, you know, to whistleblowers, Sierra Club had been doing all those FOIA requests and spending all those man hours going through paperwork and his old emails and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of that was breaking that week. So I can say I 100% made his week worse, and I feel great about that. You know, that added a little fire in him to hurry up and out than, you know, than better.
Yeah, so you were in the right place at the right time. Because, you know, I look at this latest story to break, and I'm sure you've seen it, that we're making asbestos great again, which, you know, you know, in my mind, I thought we were done with. I thought, you know, all the people who died removing this stuff and the
right.
horrible lung diseases that we've seen. And, you know, I've had, you know, bunches of people, you know, send me, you know, hey, an uncle died of this. I had my grandfather died from this. You know, why mm-hmm. in the world are we even considering this? And I guess that's right. the question I keep coming back to. What is it about these people, the Scott Pruitts of the world, who say, you know what, we're going to make all that horrible stuff great again?
Well, I mean, I think we can certainly look at the fact that these products are coming out of Russia. I mean, I think that's definitely a key here. I mean, that can't possibly be a coincidence. And what's interesting is how blatant it is, you know? I mean, it's like you're reading a headline from The Onion. It's like you're seeing a parody of something that Trump would do if he'd really lost his mind and did not care at all that we all knew that he was a treasonous traitor in the pocket of the Russians. But he's actually doing it.
Yeah, maybe he borrowed Melania's coat. I don't know. But, you know, here's the thing that gets me. And now that Pruitt's gone, I'm even more afraid, because Pruitt was a lightning rod. Even before he took office and before any of the you know, the things that we found out happened, he was somebody who attracted attention. My fear now is that now that he's gone, the person who comes behind him, just as bad ideologically, but not quite the lightning rod, not quite the attention getter, and all of the horrible things that we feared from Pruitt move forward under his replacement.
Exactly. I mean, Wheeler's terrible. He's at least as bad. He's probably more dangerous. He's not as much of a bumbling idiot. People actually like him there. You know, he knows everybody. He knows how Washington works. And obviously he was appointed because he has the, you know, same policies. He's, and that's why he was, you know, appointed in Pruitt's place in the first place. So yeah, it's going to be bad. And look at it already. It's not like he went in and, you know, put the climate change science back on the EPA website and rehiring scientists, you know, for them again. No, I mean, we've got, you know, terrible things still happening. I mean, asbestos is a particularly egregious example, but he's also, you know, they're rolling back, you know, clean car regulation. They're finding new ways to hamper scientific research around how pollutants affect people's health. So he's getting stuff done, you know, terrible stuff done at a fantastic clip at this point. And we can assume, you know, by some miracle we got rid of him, they would just appoint somebody else just as bad. You know, Trump and the administration and the GOP Congress that won't hold them accountable, they're the problem. They're the root of the problem.
You're right, which is why November is so important, because it doesn't seem to be a shortage of people with horrible ideas on the Republican side of things. And you know, I look at this, and you know, not too long ago, you know, in talking about some of the things the EPA has done, I found it quite interesting that when Pruitt got his furniture, the employee said that before we put it together, we're going to leave it in a warehouse so that it'll air out because the formaldehyde will make us sick.
Yes.
While simultaneously, they're suppressing the report that tells us that formaldehyde from this pre-manufactured furniture will make us sick.
Yes. Can you imagine? They're like whispering amongst themselves, like, oh, we think that this furniture that we've allowed the import of, you know, what if it gets our boss or the EPA, you know, and ourselves some terrible disease? You know, it's unbelievable. But no responsibility around protecting the American public or anything like that. That would just, you know, totally be on the scope, of course, of what they're there to do.
See, now I'm so cynical, I would have built it right in his office. Closed all the windows, all the doors, shut the vents, and left it right there. Because it's poetic justice, I think. Or is that cruel and evil? Does that rip at our souls?
Well, I think there's enough soul ripping happening already. I don't think that we have to worry about that. But I think as long as we're going down that path, then if Trump wants to be, you know, letting them import, you know, asbestos products, then he should obviously be the one taking that for a test drive in his own office.
We should have, Junior and the idiot one who I can never remember his name.
Nobody can.
and the youngest one who I never talk about, they should be the ones installing it and removing it. Let them be the first. It's like anything. You know what? You want it? Let you be the first to cross that threshold. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that I was, because I was doing a little research on you before you came on, and I guess I was kind of surprised that you've really taken a lot of arrows from the right wing over this. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised. Yeah. I shouldn't be shocked. But I kind of was. I was kind of surprised that, you know, because I thought you did the right thing, but you've taken some abuse.
I have. What a delight they are. But, you know, I mean, I got some postcards to my house. You know, my workplace has got you know, quite the deluge. And then, of course, everywhere, social media, email, and my phone, all kinds of things, especially during those first schools. On social media. But you know, when you get the content of it, you can't take it seriously. First of all, that kind of vitriol is from a minority of people out there, and a lot of them are fueled by Russian bots. So you can't take it seriously. And when there's things like, oh, that's not civil, and literally, it's not like I was yelling. I had my child with me. I just went up, you know, I spent a minute, you know, telling him what I took issue with. And then you don't get much more civil than that, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell you had a little adrenaline going. You were kind of, I thought you held back quite well. I mean, again, I would have never done it because I would not have been as tactful. And I certainly would not have been as calm, which is why I thank you for being the one, because I just couldn't do it. Because look, here's the thing: I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and during the 70s, at a time when industry was just polluting like no other. We had asthma indexes. As a kid, I suffered horribly from asthma. Lake Erie was almost completely dead. The only fish you ever saw were floating sideways, looking up with one eye. So the policies that we moved forward on for clean air and clean water and all of this stuff, the lead out of gasoline so we don't have acid rain anymore, all of these policies made the environment and my breathing better and my children's breathing better. So the idea that we're going to go backwards and end up where we started from is just insane to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's appalling. It's enraging. And when you think about the way that communities of color and that low-income communities and really those who are most vulnerable in our country, the way that they suffer and how much time and how much effort and fighting it has taken to, you know, move forward at all, and it's all being rolled back so quickly, it really is enraging. It really is. But, you know, we have to stay strategic in our fight back against this.
Yeah. Now, yesterday, I thought there were some good themes came out of yesterday. The Ohio 12th. I know a lot of people are down over that O'Connor lost, but I think come November.
Well, hey, there's a few ballots still out. Those provisional ballots. It's probably not going to do it for us, but.
But, you know, the next election is only 3 months away. And the Republicans aren't going to be able to outspend 5-1 in the next election. So I think it could be close. And the positive I take from it is there are probably 70 races across the country that were much closer than that seat was, that Democrats are going to be much more competitive in. And ultimately, I see a bloodbath coming in November. Yeah, I think we lost her.
Hello, can you hear me?
I didn't hear your response.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I see the outcome in Ohio, despite not getting Danny in there, as very positive. I'm excited. I think that this means that this bodes very badly for the GOP. I think that all those people who came out to vote for Danny are going to come back, and that we're going to be ready to pull in a whole lot more people. And I think that the fact that we were able to do so well there means that we're going to be doing a whole lot better in a whole lot other, you know, more purple areas. So I think it means big trouble for the GOP, and I don't want to get too optimistic about it until, you know, November 7th. But I think that we have reason to hope, and it's just going to be super vital, super important for all of us to, gosh, really treat this as the election of our lives.
Like, 'cause it is.
This is the big one.
No, it is.
Exactly.
And this should be, you know, I'm saying November 6th should be let's have the biggest march in the history of civilization and march our behinds right to the polls.
Yes, absolutely. It can't be one of those things where, like, voting is enough. Like, everybody who's going to vote, you need to get, like, 10 more people to vote with you. Everybody who's motivated about voting, you need to be participating in Get Out the Vote Act in the lead up to it. You need to be, even if it's just, you know, making a calendar event and scheduling a voting party where you're going to invite a bunch of your friends to come over and you're all going to go to the polls together and then you're going to, you know, come back and crack a couple beers about it. You know, whatever it is, you're going to get involved with Swing Left, if you're going to make phone calls, everybody needs to be 20 times, 100 times more involved than they have ever been in an election before. And if we do that, because if we do that, we will win. We will absolutely win. We can take the House and the Senate. But everybody needs to be in it to win it, like their lives depend on it, because a lot of people do. Our future does. Our climate does. So
you're absolutely right. And then keep that momentum for 2020, because 2018 is not the finish line. I have to remind people of that, because 2020, we need to undo a lot of the damage, if we can. I mean, this administration has already done enough damage. I can't imagine much more. But you're right. Got to get to the polls. Any final message? Any thoughts? You know, anything positive? Something uplifting?
Well, hey, this is all. I'll say this: protesting is fun. Getting out the vote is fun. Engaging is fun. Like, it's a good time. We don't need to spend all of our time just being mired in the anger and frustration. There is a lot of fun in getting out and taking to the streets and taking action. It's very satisfying. It's very empowering. You make a lot of friends, so I think that's how we stay engaged. You know, we're dealing with really upsetting issues, but we can have a good time as we do it, and that's how we're going to be able to make this a marathon.
There you go. While the right may have all the money and the billionaires may have all the money, we've still out-procreated them. We can still outvote them.
Absolutely.
Kristen, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. Good on you. Keep it up.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thanks so much, Kristen Mink. Again, you know, I couldn't have done it. No way. None whatsoever. Love to hear your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1850. That was the day that two tailors who were out on strike in New York City were killed in a confrontation with the police. It is thought that they were the first workers to die while participating in a strike in the United States. They certainly would not be the last. The United States has one of the bloodiest labor histories of any industrial nation. It's estimated that at least 700 people have lost their lives to violence during a strike. The vast majority of those slain were workers. Some of the most bloody conflicts included the Great Upheaval of 1877, where across the country, 100 workers lost their lives in an uprising of railway labor. Then, in 1892, the strike against Carnegie Steel in Homestead, Pennsylvania, 9 strikers and 3 Pinkerton agents died. 2 years later, 30 workers died across the country in a boycott and strike against the Pullman Palace Car Company. One of the most infamous labor massacres occurred in Ludlow, Colorado in 1914. During this coal mining strike, gun thugs hired by the company rained machine gun bullets and fire down on a tent colony of striking workers. At least 19 people were killed. 11 of them were children. In 1937, 10 workers died on Memorial Day at a demonstration against Republic Steel in Chicago. These are just some of the battles, massacres, and murders that shaped the American labor movement. Too often, the toil of this bloodshed is not taught in history classes. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
The most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Tell you one of the more despicable things I've seen today. Alex Jones, who never been a fan of, I've met him a couple of times. Actually, had a lucid conversation with him. About 20 minutes. Seemed like a decent guy at that moment. And then, you know, seconds later, went from zero to crazy in a blink of an eye. But regardless, one of the more despicable things I've seen. He and his lawyers are now in this defamation trial, demanding that all of the people who have brought claims against them publish their home address and their birth dates. Now, they're claiming this is Texas law and it has to be this way. I got to tell you, I'm really uneasy with the lunatics and the kooks that follow him putting anyone's name and phone number and information out for these people to have any access to. And if these folks are forced to do it, I think anything that happens to them should come back on Jones, and he should be the one going to jail. Just my thought. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C. I got Doug Christians, Talk Media News. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
So what do you think of this? Do you think that these folks should have to put their, even it is the law that they have to publish their, at least put their address and their birth date. Do you think they should have to?
I feel that Alex Jones is playing the media to a T, and that he is trying everything he can to embarrass those whose lives he has hurt so much, and doing it every way he humanly can. And everything that he does should be seen with a jaded eye. He's just about selling fake drugs. That's what he really does, is sell fake drugs and use crazy conspiracy theories to get the craziest of the crazy to come on board with him.
I mean, the thing that gets me is this guy's got a history of doing this stuff, of publishing people's home addresses and their phone numbers and all of this stuff so that, you know, the minions will go and harass them. And, you know, you listen to some of the stories of these people whose children were murdered for no other reason than going to school. And to have someone like Jones say they're all crisis actors and it was a false flag and all of this stuff. And then to sig his minions on them, you know, harassing them on the phone, and, you know, doxing their, you know, their computers and all the stuff that goes on that these people do. And it's just, it's despicable.
It is. It's terrible. And there are people, especially the Sandy Hook families, they've had to move several times because Jones has made false allegations against them. Just to support, again, as I said, his sales of fake pharmaceuticals, because he's been making millions off of that. Oh. And he's a fraud through and through. Barnum would know exactly this kind of man. He's a circus barker. I mean, like you, I've met him. I interviewed him. I got him on. He's a he's actually a very engaging person in person, and funny too. But he is. But he has. He's got. He has no mercy. He'll do anything to build an audience. And I believe it's just cynical. I think he's doing it. He knows very well what's going to get ratings, what's going to bring it up.
No, I'm right there with you. I said that, you know, I had talked to him a couple of times. I used to go to these talkers conventions. And, you know, he was the keynote speaker, and we were, you know, kind of in the same area. We were talking for like 20 minutes over a drink back and forth. And you're right, you know, funny, engaging. You know, we had a good conversation about the industry, about, you know, sports, about, you know, all kinds of stuff. And then he took the stage, and he went from zero to absolutely bat-you-know-what crazy in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, it's surprising. I mean, actually, I was surprisingly engaged. I mean, I found it told me something about the kind of personality he is. He's almost, sociopathic, because he's absolutely able to be sane and very just there with you. And very funny. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And engaging and all that is just, I don't know which part of it is a show, but one of it is a show.
Yeah, or all of it. So are you, which side of the YouTube kicking him off, and I guess Twitter and Facebook and a bunch of people have kicked his pages and his stuff, his content off. Which side do you fall on that?
Well, I mean, do you yell, you know, fire in a crowded theater? I mean, the stuff is ridiculous. I mean, it's one thing to generate ratings. It's another thing to say things. I do believe, and I can't say I know, but I believe that he's saying things he knows to be false, and he's doing it in order to grab ratings again so he can sell his fake drugs. And, I mean, YouTube's got to set standards. I mean, if you or I did something similar to that, we would get kicked off far before this,
right,
on YouTube. So I do think that he had it coming to him.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, because I have a bunch of people go, well, freedom of speech. And I'm going, whoa. You have freedom of speech between you and your government, not between you and a private corporation or you and me. You don't have free speech rights in my household. You know, you're standing on the street corner, and that's between you and your government. They want to stop you. But in my house, nope, you're out. Same thing with private industry. It's not a free speech issue, so stop with that.
Exactly. I'm just surprised it's taken so long. And I think it may be the same kind of impulse that has scared congressmen, lawmakers, from talking up about Donald Trump. They think, Alex Jones, he's got this enormous population. I don't want to, of followers, I don't want to piss them off.
And they're crazy.
You know what? You know, I mean, seriously, you know, it's about time to
use a Sarah Palin line. Man up.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and you know, as FDR said, I welcome the opposition. Well, come on, welcome it. Put it right on. Fight back. And, of course, there's only if GOP lawmakers retiring will they actually speak their mind. They won't do it. My theory about Paul Ryan changing the subject a bit is that Paul Ryan, the reason he doesn't have a spine is because, like Eric Cantor, who left earlier, who's then taken a huge job as a lobbyist.
Well, he didn't leave earlier. He got defeated. There's a difference between voluntarily
primary,
leaving and getting your hat handed to you.
Yes, he got it primaried by a Tea Partier. But the thing is that he then, you know, turned around and got a pretty cushy job as a lobbyist. And I think that Paul Ryan hasn't announced what firm he's going to, but he sees a huge salary coming, and he doesn't want to risk that enormous salary that he could get by speaking up what he really feels about the president.
No, you're spot on.
I mean, it's a theory, but if you see him get that cushy job right as he retires, because this one he is voluntarily retiring from, as he knows that the House will be flipped over to the Democrats in November, he will make 20 times as much money, like literally, and B, he will not be a minority House member.
Well, and I thought he was going to lose anyway. Look, I mean, you've got Iron Stash out there who, you know, has a huge following. Even Kathy Myers, who's the other Democrat, you know, has, you know, a pretty good following. So there was a possibility he was going to get his hat handed to him in November anyway. But that's a whole nother thing. And let's talk about hats handed to them. Ohio 12th last night. The Republicans, you know, while they held the seat, not by much.
Not by much at all. In fact, you could only say the Republicans got that because they were willing to spend anywhere from $3.5 to $5 million to protect a seat that should have just been handed to them. The Republicans have held that seat for over 30 years. Donald Trump had won that district by 11 points. There wasn't even an issue until Donald Trump's antics came into play. Until it was pretty clear that Republicans were not going to hold this as easily as they thought.
But if you look at his Twitter feed, man, he's the one who saved it. He came in and saved the day, you know, like a superhero, an orange superhero,
claiming.
But still a superhero.
That's what he's claiming. And I think that most analysts looking at this say, wow, this doesn't bode well for Republicans, because if you're losing, I mean, if you only win by a half a percentage point in this strong Republican, this kind of a Republican stronghold, this is the wealthiest district in all of Ohio.
Yep.
This is a district with an average income per medium income about $90,000. The Republicans could have gone for tax cuts, protection of wealth for the wealthy, all these things. Instead, they went for cultural divisive issues, Danny O'Connor was a Nancy Pelosi-loving Democrat, and kind of like Connor Lamb, he is not a Nancy Pelosi-loving Democrat. In fact, he's kind of playing the Connor Lamb playbook, trying to kind of balance it a little bit. I think that they're calling them Dannycrats, those who are former Republicans that are voting for Danny O'Connor. I think they have a very high likelihood that they're going to vote for him in November.
Well, let's hope so, because, you know, at the end of this, it still is about taking back the House and adding some balance to our government, and we desperately need it. Let's move on. Speaking of Congress, another seat might be up for grabs come November. Congressman Chris Collins arrested today on insider trading. Thoughts?
Well, here's the thing. It was the FBI has been doing research on this for quite a while, and now finally came out. They have videotape of him actually doing his nefarious business. Of course, Chris Collins came up with a totally innovative term to describe the investigation into insider trading. You've never heard this term before. Nobody has.
I can't wait.
They call it a witch hunt.
Oh,
wow.
Witch hunt.
Wow. A witch hunt. We've never heard that term in these politics these days.
Wow. I'm going to have to check with our resident witch who categorically denies that witches are looking for Donald Trump. Categorically denies any support of the Trump administration. I'm going to have to see if the witches are hunting down Mr. Collins and his insider trading. What's interesting to me, though, is, you know, they've got all these text messages, they've got the paper trail and a video of him doing it, and yet I guess in this era of fake news and of witch hunts, I guess you can just deny.
Right. Well, we can also thank the late Representative Louise Slaughter, who actually filed ethics charges against Collins last June with the Office of Congressional Ethics about insider trading. So he is smiling for her grave,
yeah,
saying, Huh. You see?
Good luck
this
in prison.
What happens.
Good luck in prison. Look, we can drain the swamp right into the prison. I'm okay with that. And speaking of tapes, have you seen this story about this Amoroso who evidently she's got tapes of her and Donald too, according to Michael Cohen?
That is funny, and that is so funny. I mean, all I can say, but you know, it's not like she's a pure player in this. I mean, she was the one who bragged. She said people are going to have to learn how to bow to Donald Trump as though he's a god or something. And so, I mean,
yeah,
she was kind of blinded by his celebrity, as so many people have been. I don't know what the magic formula is that what the Kool-Aid is that he feeds his followers that feel this way, but something probably just hearing him speak unfiltered and his overt misogynistic behavior, his racism, his ignorance.
Yeah.
All combined, I mean, it's pretty shocking, really.
Yeah. And finally, our quote of the day. It was probably one of the best lines of the day. DNC Vice Chairman Michael Blake evidently was on Fox News, and the other guest asked him, well, you know, who are you as a party? You know, because a couple of the quote-unquote socialists or democratic socialists lost last night. I think the line was perfect. He said, we're the party not going to jail. So,
oh my God. And speaking of jail, there's a difference between jail and prison. Jail is where you go before you are found guilty. And there's one notable person who is now residing in jail in Alexandria, Virginia, where I am right now as we speak. And that is none other than the honorable Paul Manafort in his seventh day of trial.
Does he have his $15,000 ostrich jacket and his $1,500 satin pants? And you know, I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at this list of his you know, the purchases that he's made, and I'm going, you know, outside of the, you know, the image of being this mob tough guy, you know, he kind of, you know, and I don't want to be, you know, stereotypical of the gays, but you know, kind of sounds a little like he could be walking in the gay pride parade.
Well, I've often thought about, people might think I'm weird for saying this, but I've often thought Donald Trump, with his lispy way that he can sometimes be, is seems like he could be secretly gay. Now, I know that
nothing wrong with it. Be who you are. Be yourself. Or as my daughter reminds me, you got to live your truth. But I just find the different, the differences, vast. On one hand, you're playing the tough guy, and the other one, you know, prancing around in satin panties.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, both of them have this kind of attitude. They don't know what taste is. They're the furthest from it. And so they kind of behave as though, you know, people who don't have any taste think this is how people with taste behave. This is how people without any money or experience knowing people with money think this is how rich people behave. Both of which are absolutely false. I mean, you know, people who have grown up comfortably in wealth, you know, think pretty carefully about spending money. Yeah. Many of them don't drive the fanciest cars. Many of them just buy off-the-rack suits and stuff just because they find it ostentatious.
$15,000 ostrich jacket. And I'll tell you, I looked at it and I'm going, it looks like a cheap knockoff. It looks like something that you'd have bought on the, you know, on the Goodwill rack.
Right, right. I mean, it's a very, very strange thing. I mean, you know, and nowadays, you can think the military for this is figuring out how to kind of standardize clothing sizes so you can buy suits that are pretty close before they need tailoring.
Yeah.
And they're pretty, you know, they're pretty darn right on. And so, I mean, somebody to spend this kind of money on clothing in general, you have to kind of wonder about where their priorities are.
And it's no wonder he was broke and trying to cheat the government out of taxes. And no wonder he's in the problem he's in.
Exactly. This is a problem he created. And, of course, he got involved with Yanukovych in Ukraine, who was an absolute criminal, a thief, who, like Donald Trump, not unlike Donald Trump, had a gold toilet made for himself, and of course was thrown out by population in Ukraine, and had to run away to his daddy, Vladimir Putin. And of course, we're still trying to figure out, what did Donald Trump say in private to Vladimir Putin, his boss, and that something that he wouldn't talk in front of any of his administration or his aides about. What was that secret? Was he telling his daddy that he would do whatever he wanted? Was he telling him, was he asking if he had been, if the trade that they had made for Vlad's help in the 2016 election was, if Trump was paying adequately?
Yeah, no, we may never know. It may be like, you know, how many licks to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop. But at the end of it, I'm hoping come November we wash out, throw the bums out, we get somebody in to hold Trump accountable, we hold hearings, we have subpoena power, and we rein back in the insanity. To me, just that simple. But, Doug, I appreciate the thoughts, the times. Good luck in Alexandria. I look forward to talking to you again as the Manafort trial continues down the road.
Awesome.
Good stuff. Our good friend Doug Christians. Talk media news. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1994. President Bill Clinton posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Latino farm worker organizer Cesar Chavez. It is the highest honor granted to civilians. His widow, Helen, accepted the honor on his behalf. Chavez founded the United Farm Workers Union. He dedicated his life to organizing agricultural workers in California. Too often, agricultural workers have not received enough attention from labor leaders, despite their struggles to win better wages and improved conditions for themselves and their families. Chavez was one of the most important Latino labor organizers in U.S. history. In 1968, he helped lead a successful national boycott against California grape growers. The boycott won increased wages for those workers and demonstrated the power of the boycott in farm labor organizing. The medal ceremony was held in the East Room of the White House. United Farm Workers leaders attended the ceremony, including Dolores Huerta, the farm union's co-founder and first vice president. President Clinton's remarks in granting the medal captured the impact and sacrifice of this labor activist. President Clinton said, "The farm workers who labored in the fields and yearned for self-respect and self-sufficiency pinned their hopes on this remarkable man, who with faith and discipline, with soft-spoken humility and amazing inner strength, led a very courageous life, and in doing so, brought dignity to the lives of so many others, and provided for us an inspiration for the rest of our nation's history." In his life, Cesar Chavez never made more than $5,000 a year. And yet, the richness of his life and legacy left a lasting imprint on the cause of labor. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
So under the heading is of, yes, there's a tweet for that. Evidently on March 10th, 2013, Donald Trump tweeted out, quote, "Honest Omarosa, she won't backstab. She'll come at you from the front." This kind of interesting. How 5 years change. Turns out now we find out that evidently she was secretly recording the Trumpster. And I guess not playing it for parties. I guess you need a job, right? You need to figure out how to make ends meet. From what I understand, she's got a new book, a tell-all, that, you know, it's bluntly titled Unhinged, that she's shopping around because, look, she needs a job. She needs a job. And you know, for someone who's so careful, you got to wonder how he got himself recorded in all of these places, which is now kind of making me wonder if, you know, maybe those tapes, maybe the golden shower tapes, maybe they're true. Who knows? Quick break. Right back.